Welcome to another edition of the Major League Eating Podcast. I am Mike Antolini, and today we are going to bring you part two of the beautiful Brian interview. Before we get to Brian, let me remind you, visit ifoce.com for all your Major League Eating news. Stay connected on Facebook at facebook.com/eatfast, and follow us on Twitter at eatingcontest. Now, we are going to sit down with Brian, talk a little bit about the rankings, maybe even some Elvis, and without further ado, let me introduce Brian Sykin. Brian, how are you, buddy?
Hey, Mike. Pleasure to be back again for round two.
Yeah, here we are. It seems like it was just yesterday.
This is great.
So I know we have a lot of stuff to cover in these podcasts with you, and one topic that we didn't get to talk about last week that now we're here is the rankings. Major League Eating updated the top 50 world rankings recently last week. And, you know, George Shea has always said that you, Beautiful Brian, are one of the most underrated, maybe even underranked competitive eaters in history. I don't know if you know that, but he has said that and he says that a lot. Talk about the rankings, how you perceive them, you know, what happens when a new set of rankings comes out, and just your whole mindset there.
Okay, well, I actually came in, it's funny, because when the rankings first made their opening debut back in, I think it was late 2001, early 2002, I actually made my debut 62 out of 65. So they had 65 ranked eaters at the time. I guess they were excited about getting this thing going and trying to get as many people as they can into the system. And two of the eaters that were ranked below me happened to be female. And after I won the pickle title in May of 2002, several months later, I moved up to number 30. And then at one point, I peaked at 16 in the first few months of 2004. Other than that, you know, other than the IFOC title rally pickles, I personally never won an IFOC major. I finished third four times in my career, corned beef, watermelon, cheesecake, and pasta. I won a matzo ball qualifier to advance to the finals in 2004. And in the corned beef contest, I finished ahead of Janice, Badlands Booker, Shredder, Crazy Legs. And then we did Chicken McNuggets with Sonia and Janice at the MSG, one of the basketball games out there. And towards the midpoint of 2004, my numbers began to decline, and it sort of reflected in the rankings and the downward slide. I remember one of my worst moments in the sport was putting on a horrid performance at the Pumpkin Pie Turkey Day Invitational in November 2004. I had this, like, really bad stomach ache. I thought it was so bad, I thought it was something like colon cancer or whatever. I was sick as a dog. And the plan was for me to slam a pumpkin pie in Dale Boone's face to sort of alleviate the pain. This was before the internet, but I was in such bad shape. I couldn't stomach doing something like that. So I finished dead last, but on a positive note, the pies acted as sort of a laxative, and my pain was gone that evening.
Happy to hear that.
Yeah. But there seems to be like a general misconception, you know, regarding the ranking system amongst fans of the sport. I think it needs to be cleared up in some aspects. Many, you know, feel that the eaters should be ranked accordingly as per their non-winning margin of victory over a fellow eater, like head-to-head in the same contest. But an argument can be made in actually determining how an eater is ranked as far as margin of victory when you're referring to, like, the top 10 or 15. But after that, I personally believe that you're ranked based upon your potential as a prospect and your overall activity competing during that time frame.
Yeah, well, you bring up a good point. It's tough to, you know, across the board, have a ranking system where you're able to even go to head-to-head results with every competitor, because obviously the activity levels are different and the contest that, you know, one eater may be in is, you know, certainly not a contest that, maybe a close competitor or a closely ranked eater are in. So it's certainly not a perfect science, but you know they are out there in the they are what they are, the rankings, and right now. Yeah, go ahead.
There are people that are going to bitch and complain because they're not, especially if they're not in the top 15 or top 20. They want to have some kind of credentials or make a mark or in some way say, hey, you know what, this guy finished ahead of me, blah, blah, blah. Actually, a real good example or a case in point would be Brian Sykin, who finished ahead of a young rising star, Nick, I forgot his last name, Nick Bauer?
Yep, Nick Bauer.
Nick Bauer, in Ribs out in Mississippi. And, that was just one head-to-head contest. And, Brian Sykin might be considered an old veteran on his way out, while Nick Bauer is young and still has the time to blossom as a prospect. So that scenario certainly plays into effect when making a mid-rank determination on a specific eater. I think Crazy Legs is a permanent fixture in the sport, and his contributions in the media probably justifies the fact that he need not worry about ever falling out of the top 20. I mean, that's just my personal opinion.
Well, and I guess 2 points. So one regarding yourself and Nick Bauer. I don't have the previous rankings right in front of me, but I believe Nick was somewhere around low 30s and you were somewhere around mid 40s. And now you are at 41 and he is at 37. So I don't think
it's justifiable, absolutely justifiable, because, I would actually I wouldn't actually make a case to the IFOC and you if I was ranked ahead of Nick, but I would say to myself, I don't think that's right, because, one fluke contest is not going to make me a better eater than a Nick Bauer.
Sure. And Crazy Legs, Crazy Legs dropped. Crazy Legs was at, I believe he was 14 or 15, and, now he's 17. So, we definitely, the results and activity and kind of where, where you've finished and what you can do, everything plays a part. But like you said, it's just not a perfect exact science. Like, nothing is. I mean,
no, that's absolutely true, Mike, and I agree with your point. But let me just say this. I realize, I've been known to rib him a lot in the past, but he can eat. And many people have failed to look at his past achievements and those stats, including the titles. Some other things have overshadowed that. I don't even want to get into that stuff. But
yeah.
On the other hand, you have a guy like Alan Goldstein and Brian Subich, who've never won anything, but they're likable, sort of likable commodities to MLE and the Shays, and because of that, I believe they will remain in the top 25, give or take a few spots, unless maybe two other faces come along that are more likable.
Yeah, well, I mean, Alan made the, Alan won the wild card this year, so that was certainly an achievement that, he's the only one who can say that.
Oh, yeah, but overall, Mike, I feel that the rankings are fair. I think it's only fair to say that advancing to the Nathan's Finals really plays a huge part in deciding whether or not you're top 15 material. Joey deserves number one ranking until somebody comes along and eats 70 hot dogs and dethrones him. I take nothing away from Pat Bertoletti and Bob Shout, who are also great eaters. And the way Sonya's been coming on of late, my only regret is that she cannot share the number two spot with Pat.
It's a good point. It's because there are, with Pat, Sonya, and Bob, they all have their strengths, many strengths, of course, and they all beat each other in certain events. And I think it's just, over the consistency and the titles that, Pat was able to kind of rack up over the past, year. And that's why Bob was number two. I mean, Bob won, I think, 7 out of 9 at one point. But regardless, I don't think there's any shame in being 2, 3, 4, 41st, anything like that. So,
But you actually made a great point. And as I previously said when we first discuss the rankings, is that the only way you could really make a case for head-to-head competition as far as where an eater is ranked above another eater and so forth is like the top 10 or top 12.
Yeah, you have a large enough sample size when to really put some stats up against each other.
Yeah, because then somebody's going to make an issue of, well, you know, Sonya beat Pat in this contest. You have to bear a lot of credence to that. But like I said, when you get to the mid-rankings, the mid-ranked eaters, it's like a crap shot. It's you can't, you know, dissect each and every contest and say, well, hey, you know, he finished ahead of this one, he finished ahead of that one. So immediately, Brian Sackett has to be 40, and Nick Bauer has to be 41. No, it doesn't work that way.
Yeah, I think that we do look at everybody's results. It's just a matter of the results. They're not equally, I guess, comparable when you're looking at different contests. And then you have to really make some judgments. But overall, you know, again, the rankings are there. And, you know, the only way to, or I guess the best way to complain about a ranking is to get out there and prove to Major League Eating that you deserve to be higher with your results. And, you know, I think that history will show that we will listen.
Right. Well, there were also other, when the rankings first came out, there was a little sidebar or an asterisk next to it that there's a formula that determines the calculation of, and it included, you know, an eater as a performer or a viable commodity to the organization. So it wasn't only eating. I don't know if that still applies. But, you know, I guess it's basically the overall picture of how someone conducts himself or, you know, what's their self-worth in the organization.
Yeah, we're looking at results. You know, we're looking at numbers. Right. You know, that's what we're looking for. You know, let's talk about a little bit about the King. I don't know if you've seen, but January 8th, 2011, we will be back at the Isle Casino Hotel in Biloxi for the second annual Peanut Butter and Banana Sandwich Eating Championship. And
Elvis has entered the building.
Yes. many, I'm sure, know, you flew out to Biloxi last January and put on an undercard event prior to the championship, donned the Elvis, donned the King's gear for his 75th birthday and really wailed out there. So how did Elvis enter into kind of the Beautiful Brian lore?
Well, it's I don't want, without going into the Elvis Presley story, which I don't want to turn this I don't want to turn this podcast into something like that. But basically, Mike, when I was a kid, Elvis Presley was not a household name in our family. I grew up as a very young child in the early 60s. And I never heard of him until I was 13. Now, the name might have come up in conversation, but that was it. Maybe it was due in part to my parents being born in a different generation. Swing era, Al Jolson, Frank Sinatra. You know, if my dad was born in the late 30s or early 40s instead of 1918, things might have been a hell of a lot different, and Elvis would have been all over the house. But my mom and dad, you know, they were also considered artists in their own right. My mom was a violinist. My dad was a painter. He wasn't a painter in trade, but he would put together some interesting, you know, canvas artworks. Problem was he never actually got a chance to ever finish them. But would my dad sit me down and show me pictures of Elvis or the King of the rock and roll era? No. He was more of a history buff, and he thought it best to educate me on world events like, you know, World War II, the presidents. And the four albums that I remember as a kid that we had in the house that I would listen to was My Fair Lady, Mary Poppins, West Side Story, and the first, and the Beatle album. I mean, you had to virtually live in a shelter, a bomb shelter, not to know who the Beatles were. Those were the four prevalent record albums that spun on an old symphonic Victrola, and the grooves on the record were basically deteriorated after that needle got a hold of them. I mean, just play them to death. So this was like early to mid-60s. So Elvis at that point was sort of passé and out of the limelight. So this proves what a powerful influence the British invasion inflicted upon the youths of our society. As a teen, I only remember seeing Elvis movies on TV, but what intrigued me the most about him was how he portrayed, or maybe a better term is how he carried himself in the movie. As far as looks, he made his supporting male cast look pale compared to him. I don't know if that's how the producers designed to make it look that way, or just the fact that he was a leading man in each and every one of his films. I don't know. But he had a crude, no-nonsense manager, his name was Colonel Parker, that was able to secure like a $1 million per movie and a 50% of the movie profit deal, regardless of how bad the movies were. So both made lucrative deals with the movie studios, and they made big money in the process. No matter how bad the scripts were, the films were just basically another avenue to promote the next song. That was it. So the movies like West Side Story and A Star Is Born, those were the bad moves that his manager made, because he was supposed to have starred in those movies, but unfortunately something went awry, and that was the end of that. So I do remember distinctly that in 1973, my mom is glued to the TV set watching Elvis in Hawaii, and I sat through 10 minutes of it, went in my room, and listen to Pink Floyd and Led Zeppelin, because to me, like, Elvis, when I was a teenager, was like some old dude aching for some kind of comeback. And it wasn't until he passed away that I started taking an interest, because the Elvis phenomenon was absolutely incredible. For the first time, I bought some of his singles, and I started listening to them, enjoying them. And I was introduced to, like, a whole new spectrum of rock and roll. And I remember my grandmother said she was watching that last Elvis special after he passed away. They showed one of his last concerts, and she was like, "Oh my God, what happened to this guy? I mean, you know, he was like tremendous, he was like a whale." And you know, after seeing that, I just got the bug. I picked up the guitar. I was in my late teens at the time. Started strumming, like, I think it was "That's All Right, Mama" or whatever. And treat me like a fool, you know. And my mother took a liking to that, and she says, "Why don't you play that again?" And from that point on, I was like, you know, I said, "Let me give it a shot and see what I have." And you know, I went to this club called Pips in Brooklyn, performed it once, performed a little Elvis there, and that was basically about it. And then I put the vocal cords, you know, to pasture for a long time. And then it wasn't until, I think, last year, after I did my Stick to Blogging album, which didn't go over too well with the critics, who was the, you know, most viable entertainer in the media today, in the world? And it was Elvis Presley. I said, you know what, if I'm going to get any kind of attention, let me try to focus on Elvis and see if it, you know, see if it carries over with the IFOC. I always said to myself that if I'm going to do Elvis, you know, you have to do it right. First of all, don't go to Vegas and do Elvis. I'm just going to get destroyed by the competition. Because in Mississippi, the Elvis impersonators, you know, they're like a handful. You go out to, you know, when we did our concert in Biloxi, the night before, this guy Shane Tucker comes on there, and he's like, I said, "Oh God, how am I going to top this guy?" But for some reason, the crowd seemed to forget him real fast. And when I got up there, I says, just forget about who was up there the previous night, and do your thing, and, you know, see how it goes over. And what I try to do is not focus on the hits that he's been known for all his career. Try to do some of the unknown or the deep tracks and see if that goes over well with the crowd. And I took a shot, and I guess it met with some approval. I was really pleased about that.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, we liked it. Well, Brian, I want to thank you again for dedicating some time and some history and some of your stories and experiences with us. I know we ended the last one asking if you would come on for a second show. Do you think there's a little left in the tank for a third?
Absolutely, Mike. You know, there's so much to talk about in my 13 years with the IFOC, and you know, I would have to write a book in order to, you know,
just do it proper justice.
All the joy and the great times I've had. I mean, it's been such a great experience. I can't even describe it. Getting to know these people, getting to make new friends, the camaraderie. Getting to know George and Rich, I mean, you know, it's just been, and yourself, it's been fantastic. And Dave Baer, by the way, I don't want to leave him out. He's a centerpiece in my entire career with the IFOC. And it's just been a joy. And like I said, there's a lot to say.
There's always next week, and we've loved having you as a part of the Major League Eating Circuit, and we will certainly, you know, open this back up next week.
Okay, great.